Good morning, everyone, and what a pleasure it is to welcome you all to the Middle East Center. First thing on a crisp, bright winter morning, 9 a.m. of seventh week with the end of term in sight. I'm glad to see that everyone has so much energy as to still be giving it their full. But of course you have, because we have, since the appointment of Professor Rehan Ismail, been able to relaunch our program in Contemporary Islamic Studies. And with that, we have seen a whole new level of engagement and activity, and our center hosting more and more speakers who are at the cutting edge and shedding new light on a crucial area of research as well as of public interest for us all. And so, having watched all of this begin to unfold, it's with great excitement that I'm here to welcome you to today's one-day workshop on transnational Islamic movements, global and local realities. We will have a series of panels through the course of the day. The program is quite charged, and so we will be keeping to a pretty strict 20 minutes per speaker.
Love how you looked at me.
No hints dropped, Hisham, and then we will take questions for all of our speakers grouped together at the end, where we should have a good half hour for the Q&A. We may have some slight adjustments to be made in the course of the panel, but if we can roll with the punches, we're very confident that you can too. It just remains for me to thank everyone who made today possible. I really want to thank Rehan for the intellectual leadership she's brought to getting this program off to such a brilliant restart. I want to thank our amazing admin team, both Jenny Williams, who has been, as always, extremely helpful on logistics, but Caroline Davis, who is just, you know, a dream to work with, and for all of her hard work in making this go so smoothly, I think we all have to express a word of thanks. So as not to eat into the time of our speakers, I will stop my introductions there. Welcome. It's great to have you all here. And we will now start with the first panel, Intra-Muslim Relations and Geopolitical Transformation. I am your chair, and our first speaker is the excellent Hisham Hellier. Hisham, over to you.
That's very kind of you, Eugene. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. It's been a long time since I've been back at St. Anthony's in the Middle East Center. I blame it on COVID. I blame everything on COVID. I used to live only about 5 minutes away that way. And I remember coming to St. Anthony's a few years ago to talk about Egypt, actually. I'd just done a book on the aftermath of, or the day after of, the 2011 revolutionary uprising. So it seems I'm talking a lot about day after stuff. And the title of my presentation today is The Day After October 7th and the Geopolitical Transformations in the Wider Arab Region. But before I get started, I'd also like to extend my thanks to Rehan for her very kind invitation. My very strange travel schedule meant I had to go back and forth several times, and she tolerated and entertained my numerous requests. So again, I thank you. Caroline is probably somewhere trying to, you know, figure out the crises that arise from having panels like this, but I'd like to put on the record that I'm very appreciative for all of her assistance as well. So before I start, so I did choose the title, so I'm not blaming anybody for this, but when I said day after, I just want to put a bit of a proviso, because this phrase has been very commonly used over the past year to talk about Gaza, the day after Gaza. And I just want to be very clear here, I'm not talking about that at all, because we're already living the day after in Gaza. And I know a lot of people won't be happy to hear that, but this is the day after. I'm happy to talk about that later if people want to, but there is no prospect for anything particularly different than what we see now, except worse. So I'm not talking about some sort of, you know, massive change in Gaza, but the day after is pertinent because of the time that we're living in. Now, the geopolitical transformations in the wider Arab region, again, something I chose because I prefer the wider Arab region over the Middle East, apologies, then yes, there's definitely a day after October 7th, and of course that's October 8th, but let's map out what October 6th looked like, okay, so instead of day after, day before. So there are certain trends that were definitely underway prior to October 7th, that were already changing by the time we got to October 7th. So five things that I wanted to just, you know, put on the mantelpiece, as it were, before we deconstruct. Saudi and Iran. Saudi normalization, broadening of Abraham Accords, that's two. Turkey, Egypt, that's three. Qatar, GCC, that's four. And Syria, Ahmetan, or generally speaking, that's five. Were all of these prior to October 7th? So the Saudi versus Iran, and you know, Eugene and I were talking about this just before we started, the Saudi versus Iran rivalry, as it were, had really started changing quite a fair bit. And if you go back to the first Trump administration, I always wanted to say the only Trump administration, this Irish, we're all going to have to get used to saying the first Trump administration. When it came to their rivalry, of course, the Saudis during the first Trump administration viewed it as a time where they could raise the tempo on Iran and get something out of it. And I think that other countries in the GCC for a time felt the same. Okay? And certainly from 2016 to at least 2018, 2019, I would argue there was this escalation paradigm in play, in that the Turks thought that they could push in a certain way and get something out of it. The Saudis thought they could push in a certain way and get something out of it. The Emiratis vis-a-vis the Qataris thought they could push in a certain way and get something out of it. By the time you get to the last sort of 12 months of the Trump administration, that changes. And it changes, I think, primarily, frankly, out of exhaustion, but also out of realization that the quote-unquote permissive atmosphere that a Trump administration had provided for was quite likely coming to an end, where powers in the region recognized that a Biden or a Democrat administration of any type was not going to allow this any further, and that it wouldn't be advantageous to continue in that same sort of fashion. I bring this up because I'm going to talk about how this is very different this time around later. So you see the de-escalation paradigm coming in. That's true versus that's true when it comes to Saudi versus Iran. That's true on Turkey versus Egypt. Turkey, of course, starts making a lot of overtures over to Egypt, and the Egyptians respond, you know, kind of playing hard to get, but you know, they're all on the same track. The same thing in regards to the GCC versus Qatar. Even though I suspect the Emiratis weren't really enthusiastic from day one, but they went along with it because the Saudis made it very clear, okay, we're done. And then, of course, on Syria, Bashar al-Assad was still out in the cold, but you know, people generally sort of coming to the idea that, yeah, he's not going anywhere. The last part of it is the normalization track. There was, of course, the Abraham Accords in the last year of the Trump administration. And you had the expanding of the Abraham Accords being one of the most pronounced and probably the only really pronounced foreign policy objective of the Biden administration when it came to the Middle East for several years. There was no Middle East policy, is what we're fond of saying in Washington, in the Biden administration, with the exception of expanding the Abraham Accords and, quote unquote, keeping things quiet, okay, which isn't exactly much of a policy. It didn't succeed very well, as we can see over the past year and a half. When it came, though, to the Saudi normalization pact with Israel, I want to say things moved. They didn't get as close as people think they got. And it wasn't because the Saudis were not willing to make certain moves. It's because in order to get the sort of three-pronged key into the keyhole and twist it in just the right way, you have to have movement within Israeli politics, from within the American Senate on security guarantees for the Saudis, and something symbolic maybe, but significant to some extent on the Palestinian file. All this is pre-October 7th. That's where we were, you know, let's say on October 6th. October 7th happens, and I think that October 7th is a very monumental milestone in the region for everything that happens thereafter. Okay? You know, many of your students in the room, I think that when people write about 2023, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, it's going to be deeply significant, because the changes that happen as a result of the repercussions of that day, I don't think it really be underestimated at this point. Lots of movements, lots of change, and of course, tremendous catastrophe. I'm a lawyer by training, so I find it instinctively, as a lawyer by training, difficult to conclude that certain things are what they are in legal terms. So I don't call what happened in Gaza over the past year a genocide on a legal basis, because I'm just waiting for the court. It's as simple as that. But if we look at the number of experts, if we look at all of the definitions that exist in law, I find it very hard to believe that any court looking at even a fraction of the evidence is going to come to a conclusion that isn't consistent with concluding it's genocide. And you're living that, and we're all living that. So it's been a very troubling year in that regard. Now, going back to these five particular geopolitical realities. So Saudi versus Iran. Well, the Saudis have normalized relations to an extent, but far more than they have in recent years with Iran, to the point where you saw over recent weeks, even against the backdrop of a Trump election and success in the United States, the Saudis making it very clear nobody should impinge on Iranian sovereignty. That was a message to Israel, but it was a message also to the United States, that you're not going to be able to peel us off and create some sort of anti-Iran axis. And I don't think that they were kidding about that. I don't think this was purely PR. I think that they realized that the circles, when they're put in motion like that, can have really deleterious consequences for the Saudis as well as for the Iranians. And of course, the Iranians made it very clear, you come after us, we're going to come after your assets in the region. Of course, what they're talking about are the GCC states. The normalization piece and the Abraham Accords, forget it. It's not happening, at least not in the short to medium term. Not because the Saudis have suddenly become, you know, diehard supporters of Palestinian sovereignty, but because they know there's no way for them to normalize with a regime that is guilty of this level of destruction, not simply in Gaza, but of course Gaza's the biggest part of it, but also in Lebanon, and also is looking forward to doing a lot more in the West Bank and the wider story around the Palestine question. And, you know, the Saudis do pay attention to local pressures, to domestic pressures. It's not a democracy, let's not kid ourselves, but it does pay attention. And it also pays attention to the way in which Saudi Arabia is presented on the international stage in the wider Arab world, but also in the Muslim world writ large. When it comes to a lot of the other files, Turkey versus Egypt, I mean, Turkey, the Turks and the Egyptians are trying to get along with each other as much as possible. There's a lot of coordination on many different files. Qatar versus GCC, just over the last few days, you've seen very high-level representations between Qatar and the UAE, and that's the main fault line, and I think that that's very clear that they don't have to like each other, and they actually don't like each other too much, but they are aware that the future for success for both of them, the region, relies on not causing fights where they're not necessary. Syria is looking very interesting over the last few days in particular, because you have, when we get to the axis issue, okay, because of course the axis of resistance. I put resistance in quotation marks for two reasons. One, because of academic integrity, but also because there's no such thing as resistance that includes a regime like Bashar al-Assad. I want to make that very clear. But the way in which that particular axis has, I won't say crumbled, I don't think that that's quite fair, but the idea of Hezbollah, for example, being this almost impenetrable, invulnerable, you know, incredible resistance movement that was going to leave Israel shivering in its boots. Well, that didn't happen. Okay. And what we've seen instead is that, although I don't think that they've taken out the operational capacity of Hezbollah, but I do think they've degraded it quite significantly. And they certainly managed to degrade and remove a huge part of its leadership, tier one and tier two. Okay. When it comes to Hamas, of course, Hamas, again, it has not disintegrated, it has not disappeared, it's not going to disappear, neither of these movements are going to disappear, but the strength of them and the ability of them able to coordinate with each other and other members of the axis okay, has certainly been called into question. Hamas was expecting, for example, after October 7th, that the Axis would sort of launch into operation. And the Axis, by the way, is not simply Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah. There are other groups that exist, of course, the Houthis in Yemen, different militias in Syria, different militias in Iraq, and even further afield if you want to go into the subcontinent. But I won't say nothing happened. The Houthis obviously stopped all of our Amazon packages coming on time. But the impact of the Axis on changing the direction of what was happening in Gaza was virtually non-existent. The Israelis destroyed Gaza. The Israelis pummeled Gaza into the ground and leveled it. And it did so to a point where the ICC has issued arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, where the ICJ, as I said, is hearing a case on genocide. None of that was changed as a result of the Axis. Okay? Iran was struck directly. Okay? An assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, the day after the inauguration of the new president. Okay? Right in the heart of Tehran. The idea that the Axis was this very, very powerful thing, I think has been fundamentally called into question. I don't think it's irrelevant. I think that we have to think of it more of a network that can exact certain prices over a very long period of time. So, you know, death by a thousand cuts, as it were. But it's not death. It's very, very annoying. You see that, of course, when it comes to Hezbollah as well. And Hezbollah has been pushed back tremendously within Lebanon. And there will be a reconfiguration in Lebanon where the Lebanese state is either stronger or falls into complete state collapse and possibly civil war. I don't think that the latter is likely. I think the former is much more likely given everything else that is going on. But of course, what we also saw in the last few days were Syrian rebels recognizing that the Axis is at one of its weakest points in the past 15 years, if not longer, and they took the war to Bashar. And they certainly seem to make impressive gains in Syria over the last few days. So we'll see how that all works out. I want to say one last thing, which is geopolitics in the region is never simply about the region. Geopolitics in the region is fundamentally about the depth of involvement from other powers external to it, most of all the United States. And what we've seen from the United States over the past year in particular is an abrogation of international law on a level that I did not imagine would be possible in the Biden administration. So all of these countries know very well, except for Israel, they're on their own. They're not getting help from the US, except from Iran. So if Iran were to declare war on any of them, they could count on the US. But apart from that, the US is not going to be saying, we'll stand by you in accordance with our treaties, or we'll stand by you in accordance with international law, or in accordance with any sort of multilateral treaty. That's not it. So instead, what we are seeing and what I think we will continue to see are a lot of quote-unquote middling powers trying to hedge and prepare themselves for very, very destructive potentials going forward, particularly on the Israel-Palestine question. So it's not looking particularly great, and we haven't even seen a Trump to take office yet. So with that very optimistic note, I thank Rehan again for her kind invitation, for Eugene for keeping me to time, and for all of you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you, Hisham.